across the city and South Cambridgeshire.
This is Louise Wilson.
Cambridge 105 Radio.
2 years ago, you may remember the story in the news of a local GP, along with his wife and two others, who were taken hostage in the Niger Delta. They are a Christian couple who are missionaries, and they set up a charity called New Foundations in the Niger Delta. That's to offer medical care to the locals, as well as the opportunity to work for the charity. Ian Squire, their friend, was shot dead, but thankfully David, Shirley and the other worker were freed. David and Shirley have now written a book called Counting the Cost, Kidnapped in the Niger Delta. And Shirley is here to kind of talk about the experience and how they are moving on. So, first of all, welcome.
Hi.
Thank you so much for joining me today. I guess it's one of those situations that you just never think is going to happen to you, although you weren't unaware that where you were was dangerous.
Yeah.
But it's just one of those things that I guess never, ever crosses your mind, does it?
Well, because of the area, we did know it was a high risk for kidnapping. But we, you know, having said that, we've been going there for nearly 16 years now. So 15 of those years, 14 years, we had some close shaves, but we're always safe. So you kind of get more complacent, I suppose, and think we're kind of very safe.
So how often were you going out there then?
Four times a year for up to a month at a time. And then back, obviously, to work and earn money just to live, and for David to keep his licence active as a GP.
Yeah, so. And what was the initial draw, I suppose, for you to go there? Because, I mean, you know, I guess in this country, it's, like you say, it's easy to get complacent. You know, you're in your own little sort of bubble, if you like. We're very comfortable in this country. We don't have, you know, those situations are very, very rare in this sort of, you know, in this country. So why did you want to go and set up a charity there specifically?
I guess the short answer to that is we didn't want to go. It had never been on our radar. And I suppose you've opened a box there, really, because prior to that even entering our heads, we were living a very affluent life in Cambridge. David, GP, boys in private school. You know, to all intents and purposes, we were living the dream. You know, plenty of holidays. But having said that, we were living way beyond our means, but that's what everyone was doing. We had met at university as Christians. We had got married as Christians. And just life had got in, and we just kind of sidelined our Christianity and just were enjoying doing other things. But for anyone who knows what a Christian is, which is when you actually accept the reality of Jesus Christ, it doesn't leave you. So it's always there, even when you're walking the other way. And I suppose we'd walked so far the other way that we had actually ended up at a point where our marriage was in threat, under threat. Our whole life was just literally had hit the bumpers. And we'd sat and talked and thought, you know, quite civilizedly at times, that, you know, we'll get divorced and we'll bring the boys up and try and stay friends. And that was really how, and we'd been going to secular counselling, which really actually made it seem like a huge problem that was going to take years to unpack. And it was just heart-sinking. And I think I went out for a drive one day and was just thinking, is this really how it's got to be? You know, I had made a vow myself, because my mum and dad divorced when I was seven, that it would never happen to me. And I had two sons who I love dearly. And I just thought, this is not what I'd ever planned. And really, you know, people can say what they like, but I heard inside, not a loud audible voice, but inside, I heard a voice sort of saying, go and see George McKim. So he was a pastor that we had heard. Well, I'd met him at my sister's husband's funeral. And at the time, I wasn't obviously interested in church or Christianity. But I remember meeting him and thinking, whoa, this is a man of integrity and something very different about him. And so it came as a bit of a surprise, this sort of inner voice saying, go and see George McKim. I hadn't thought about him for years. So I went home and I thought, actually, that's what I'll do. I'll go up to Scotland, I'll see my sister and I'll just go and see him, you know, and reconnect with my Christian roots and my Christian background. So I went home and told David that's what I was going to do, and he said, I'm coming too. So we thought, well, okay, we'll go up. So the four of us went up, the boys as well. We stayed with my sister. We went to church. We had a meeting with George McKim. It was nothing sort of, you know, earth-shattering. He was just very biblically counselled us through what marriage was. And then he sent us for prayer to a lady in the church that you would have bypassed, an elderly Irish lady. But she had a powerful ministry in prayer. So she prayed with us, and over a series of times we met with her and she prayed with us. And quite honestly, we never really discussed with her what our problems were. And they were myriad at that time. You know, we were drinking a lot, we were partying a lot, we were doing everything we shouldn't be doing, to be honest. And we didn't actually divulge to her what was going on, but during the time she was praying for us, well, particularly she would see us together and sometimes separately. When she was praying for me on my own, through her prayer, she was saying the things that had been happening in her life. So I got a real rude awakening and thought, my goodness, God really does see everything and he is real. So it was at that, during that period of time, we were attending George McKim's church and a pastor from Nigeria was talking. And he talked about this area. And to be honest, we couldn't have been less interested at all. But during this period, we had changed everything in our lives, rededicated our lives to our faith, to Jesus Christ, and decided that it was all or nothing. On, you know, either we went fully into that or we rejected it outwardly and completely, which we couldn't do. So we really did everything, changed everything. We sold our big house, pulled our boys out of private school. David left his job, which was a bit toxic because of the working hours and, you know, just so many things. We weren't seeing each other, we weren't spending time. So we ended up selling up. We moved to a starter home in Camborne, which we rented, and we just started to put our lives back together and just, you know, really licking our wounds, trying to look after ourselves and our boys and bring our family back together. But this time prayerfully and with God at the centre. And so it was during this period in Camborne, which was our kind of retreat. It was a great place for us to be because we were still near enough Cambridge to see people, but away from the kind
from
of
all
top,
the things that were drawing you out of, yeah.
Social life, which was, you know, a lot of drinking, you know, but in the most middle-class way. So yeah. It was quite acceptable, wasn't it?
Mm.
But actually, for us, it wasn't. It was destructive. So we, you know, we're putting ourselves together. And during, I think, the 6 months following hearing this pastor talk, this would not leave us alone, this thing about this horrible part of Nigeria, because we had no interest. Our areas that we used to like to go to were the other side of Africa, you know, Tanzania or South Africa, lovely areas, lovely landscapes. The Niger Delta is not lovely. It's the oil-producing area. It's been decimated because of the oil production. It is on the bottom centiles for the World Health Organization health indices, which it shouldn't be. It's the sixth largest oil producer in the world. So it had nothing that would draw you in the natural.
Isn't the joke, never say you're not going to go somewhere because that's where he'll send you, you know. Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it literally, this 6 months of wrestling with it, and it was really, I can't explain it, it's just like an obsessive thought that was there all the time. Even when we were sleeping, we would dream about it. So we would talk about it and think, well, what does this mean? And eventually I said to David, because it was so consuming, why don't we just go out for a visit? Let's just go and see what's there. And we phoned up George McKim and said, look, we're going to go out and just for a visit, and you're coming too because you got us into this. And to his credit, he did come.
Well done him.
So we did. We took our youngest son out of school and we took him with us. You know, some would say it was naive. Others would say it was stupidity. Because when we arrived there, it was in civil war and lockdown. So we ended up in a hotel, locked up in a room for the bulk of the time with armed guards. We couldn't actually go out anywhere. But on the last couple of days, that was lifted. So we were able to travel to the Delta area, which is where we'd felt the straw. And we went and looked around a number of communities and were, you know, thoroughly shocked at what we saw. You know, if you could describe it in terms that people would probably understand, it looked like kind of Stone Age living, people cooking on open fires outside, no clean water, no electricity, no infrastructure, no roads, just very rudimentary. And you're thinking, but this is the 20th century, you know, going into the 21st century. This is crazy. What's going on?
And I guess at that point as well, most people would just be like, no way, but yeah. You still felt that draw. And
well, it was worse than that, because as we went round, and you know, we've got our, at that time, 11-year-old son with us, we looked around these, and the more communities we went to, the more we just felt God saying, this is where I want you. And it was a very definite, this is it. So we didn't discuss it, we didn't say much. We did, you know, had, as I say, just a couple of days at the end of the trip because of the civil war. But it confirmed our, if you like, worst nightmare that it was being called to an area that we had no natural affinity to.
So then you set up this, you know, this charity called New Foundations, yeah. And that's to offer medical care to the people living there, and also, as I mentioned earlier when I was talking about it, an opportunity as well for the people there to work for the charity as well. But I know that you're very stringent about who you allow to work, aren't you? You're very careful about who you allow to work for you, because you want to keep it, you know, a tight ship and know exactly what's going on. Because I guess, not to sort of be too general about it or flippant about it, but I guess there must be a lot of corruption as well.
Nigeria quite often is synonymous with corruption, although that's unfair, not everyone is, but you know, it's a lot of big scams come from Nigeria.
We get the emails, don't we? So let's kind of move on to this particular event then. I mean, was there anything that sort of built up to it, was there any warning signs, if you like, that something was going to kick off in terms of being, you know, taken captive?
I think looking back, there was an uneasiness even before we went, and I certainly at that time didn't want to go to this particular trip, neither did Ian. David's mum was ill at the time, she was terminal with cancer, and I felt we should be at home. And but we had so many commitments to be there. So we had this wrestling with it. We were meant to be there, and it was right that we went. That was where we were meant to be, because we have to remember, for us, God is always in control. So nothing happens to him as an accident. To us, it might come as a surprise, but he knew all the things that were going to happen, and they were for a purpose. So there was an uneasiness before going, and it was a strange kind of week. There was a lot of, because we'd not been for, I think, 8 months deliberately trying to leave them to manage themselves, and we're trying to hand over. That's always been the big thing. So it would be Nigerian led and Nigerian run, and we would step back and just be mentors in the background, never realising it would come quite as dramatically and quite as suddenly. So we'd left them deliberately. When we arrived, there were quite a few issues. And I think there was one issue in particular. We went to the clinic the minute we arrived, and I was just walking around. There was a very, you know, it was full, actually. There was lots of babies in, which is quite common. But there was one baby, and it just looked so ill. And I looked at the notes that were at the foot of the bed, which should be kept up to date. And the notes and what I was seeing in the baby weren't matching up. So I called the staff and I said, who's been looking after this baby? And I looked around at them and they were just all wandering around. And then I looked at this baby and its mum, and I thought, this baby's almost dying. And the mum is just sitting there, and no one's clicked how serious this is, or how, you know, devastating for the mum. No one was talking to her. All the things we taught them were kind of had dissipated a bit. So that was quite a shock, that it wasn't anything technical really, but just their levels of compassion. I think they were a bit compassion weary. You know, you see so much distressful things that you have to really come back and reassess things every week, and prayerfully, you know, address how you're going to treat people, because it's so easy just to say it's another baby. But each baby
is a life.
Yes, and a very important life. Yeah. You know, each individual in Africa, wherever they are lives that have been created by God, and we feel, you know, every life is valuable. So this baby was a red flag. So the whole camp really ended up being round this incident. So it was quite tough in a sense that way. I think normally towards the end of the camp, we have what we call a gala evening, which is we all eat together. And usually a lot of guests come in from the community, like the council and just friends. This time it was quite low key and we were quite flat because it was quite, you know, a lot of things that were there. And we had Ian, obviously, who was doing ophthalmic training. We trained three people up to do refraction of eyesight, to make the glasses with a machine that Ian himself's invented, which can be run on a car battery in resource-poor areas to grind the lenses to prescription. So it's pretty miraculous, actually. So they can do, you know, bifocals, varifocals in this place where there's no running water and no electricity.
Okay. Right. On that note, we are going to come back, but I've got to do the travel now. But we'll come back to you because we're kind of just starting to unravel this. So, yeah, it's great. Right. So I'm back with Shirley. So we've kind of established why you were essentially, you know, called out to the Niger Delta and why you were there. So let's kind of go into, you know, what happened. You know, how did it all start, really?
Yeah. Well, as I was sort of saying just before the break, we used to have a gala evening kind of on the last night, and this was, by this stage, the last night we were due to leave the next morning and go back, head for Port Harcourt and fly out. So instead, as I said, of having this gala night, because it had been such a difficult camp in many respects, we had a quiet meal just with the workers. And we watched the film, actually, which was the film called Risen, which is, I can't remember his name now, but it's a secular film. It was in the cinemas, about the Roman centurion who sees Christ being crucified and says, surely this was the Son of God. And this film then follows a fictionalized event that he follows the disciples to find out if Jesus really was who they said he was. It's a really good film, actually. So we all watched that, and it was quite sobering again. And people were talking about, well, there is a cost to following Christ. There is a cost in being a Christian. We had these discussions. Then we went off to bed. We were all pretty exhausted. I suppose by this time it's about 11:30, 12 o'clock. And, you know, bearing in mind there's no electricity, so we have a generator which is on all night to keep light outside the bungalow for security. So it's kind of floodlit all the way around. And normally the generator may go off in the middle of the night because it's run out of diesel and someone gets up and sorts it. Anyway, we'd all gone off to sleep. I think Ian had gone first and Ilana had gone, who was with Ian, who's she's another optometrist from Northern Ireland. She was only 24 at the time, her first time on mission trip. And so very devastating for her. So we went to bed, basically, and we were exhausted because it had been exhausting. So there you tend to sleep, to be honest, with nothing on. It's boiling hot. I mean, the humidity's in the 90%. So we have a fan that we keep on all night because of the generator. We were just conked out, basically, and the next thing was I was lying there and I could hear this horrific crashing and banging at the front door. And I said to David, basically, what the heck is that? I woke him up. But as soon as I'd said it, we both knew exactly what it was. And I sort of stumbled. It's not a bed, it's a mattress on a floor. Sort of stumbled off the mattress. But it's pitch black if you don't have lighting, because there's no electricity anywhere. So you've got kerosene lamps and things if people don't have generators. So it was literally, you couldn't see your hand in front of your face. So I was stumbling for the light switch. I don't know why, because I thought, you know, the lights have gone off, but actually the generator had been cut. So it was pretty clear that we needed to find some clothes because we were, you know, not dressed at all. And we were half packed, so our clothes were in a tiny hand luggage suitcase on one corner of the floor. And other things were on shelves, and you couldn't see anything or find anything. So I was feeling around for something. I found a pair of trousers and pulled them on. I found a bra and put that on. And meanwhile, we could hear this crashing. They'd got through the front door. And then we could hear them banging next on Ilana's door. And they got through that. silence, and then the banging starts again. Ian's door, they got through that. And we knew our door was next, so we were desperately scrambling around. And suddenly, the door was, you know, attacked quite heavily, and lights were in our face. The next thing was just about six armed men with balaclavas on, masked face. All you could see was their eyes, dressed in camo and black. So you couldn't really see them. They were behind their torchlight, and they just came in pointing guns and shouting, "Move, move, move." And I still didn't have a top on. So I reached for one, and he kicked it away and said no. So wouldn't let us put shoes on, wouldn't let us get properly dressed. So I grabbed a kind of African wrap that I had and put it around me. And they marched us outside, very violent, very abusive at this point. And actually, during the time I was waiting in the room, I thought the worst thing we can do is leave this bungalow. So I'm going to sit down and not go. I'm just going to tell them, no, I'm not going. Everything changes when you see an AK-47 pointed at your face. You know, we're not used to seeing guns, are we, in this country? We're not used to that kind of level of violence. So all that idea just left. So we did what we were told, basically. So they pushed us. They were quite rough, particularly on Ian and David, quite, you know, bashing them and pushing them. They didn't actually really touched Ilana or I. So we were marched outside. There we saw Ian and Ilana standing in their pyjamas. And those consisted of, sadly for poor Ilana, just a tiny pair of shorts and a tiny T-shirt. Ian, a pair of shorts and a T-shirt. And one of our workers, who'd obviously thought at the time this was happening something was going on with the generator, went out. He had been bashed on the head and was lying unconscious with his head bleeding at the side. So it was a shock. The whole thing was... And so they marched us very quickly out of the bungalow, out of our compound, and it had been the rainy season. Well, it was while we were there. So everything is just soaking. So we're walking through mud, no shoes. And then they marched us across the field to a waiting boat and put us in the boat. And we took off at high speed with these men.
So where did they take you to? And, you know, what happened once you arrived there?
They set off on this boat with a... 275 horsepower engine, so that was a very fast boat for an open, just kind of, you know, fiberglass boat. And we knew we were heading the wrong way because we were heading out towards the Atlantic. We knew the other way took us into all the communities we knew, all the people we knew. The other way was towards the Atlantic and really the kind of Wild West, if you like, of that area, where there was literally even less infrastructure and less any kind of law and order. So we travelled on the boat for over an hour, and it was just, we were taken then from the main Niger River through tributaries and offcuts of the, and they actually had to punt us through eventually. But because it was the flooded rainy season, there was no ground visible. So we were punting through flooded areas, flooded creeks, and we were taken literally to the backside of nowhere, out towards the Atlantic. And it was then we knew this was pretty serious. It wasn't, you know, that area has a reputation for kidnapping of oil workers for money. And generally they kidnap an oil worker, they treat them very well, they keep them for a couple of days, the oil company pays up and they release them. There is very few stories of anything other than that happening. So we thought they made a mistake, they don't know who we are, we'll be able to explain. So although we were full of kind of fear and anxiety during this boat trip, because at that point we realised that not only were these men violent, but they were all high as kites on drugs. And it was only on the boat as we realised their breathing patterns, the way they were high. So they were irrational. So we knew we would just keep quiet, basically as low a profile as possible.
I suppose, obviously, you're in this devastating sort of situation. We're going to be heading up to the... I am slightly breaking rules here, but this is just far too good to leave. But in this situation, is there a part of you that's sort of questioning God and saying, why are we in this situation? You know, because you felt that you were there because of his calling. And, you know, it's somewhere that you didn't really want to go. And now you're facing this horrendous situation. Are you sort of saying, you know, what's going on?
At this stage, to be honest, no. At this stage, we just thought God is still in control. We did have this feeling that we would be able to negotiate with them and explain. And, you know, we were fearful, but we weren't overly fearful. I think Ilana probably was a bit more. It was her first trip away, so I was concerned for her. But at this stage, no, we didn't question, was there, you know, was this a mistake? Was it, until Ian was shot at that point.
And when did that happen?
Well, this first night, even by this time, it's probably about 4 o'clock in the morning. They took us about 2 a.m. They put us on an open platform in the middle of a flood.
We're just coming up to the top of the hour. I will come back to this. Annie's got the news at 12 o'clock and we will come back to Shirley just after that. I hope you're still with me. Not to sound flippant about it, but it's almost like a trilogy, isn't it? So we're back for sort of the third sort of concluding part. I'm with Shirley Donovan, who a couple of years ago, along with her husband and two of their workers, were taken captive in the Niger Delta. So we're kind of at the point where... So at what point was Ian shot?
Well, as I said, we probably arrived there about 4 a.m. and weirdly, we all just slept. I think when you've had a huge rush of adrenaline, your body's exhausted. So they put us on two mattresses under mosquito nets, just in an open area in the middle of a flooded delta. And we went to sleep. But as we were sleeping, somebody went round in a boat and said, it's going to be okay, don't worry. So that was very comforting. And it was somebody that could speak quite good English. Then we woke up with the sun coming up, so probably in a couple of hours later. And a boy came on a dugout canoe. He couldn't speak any English, but we sort of gesticulated to him, could we have water? He went away, brought some water in a bottle. So we were feeling, you know, this is not so bad. We're going to be able to... We'd had this somebody saying it's going to be okay. So we were just sitting on this pontoon waiting to see what was going to happen. Someone else came on a dugout canoe. They shoved onto this platform Ian's guitar. And we were just sitting in our mosquito nets. Then we needed a pee, so we had to get up and pee over the side of this pontoon. You know, all your
dignity goes out the window.
Yeah, everything goes out the window. So, you know, we were just sort of mooching around there, wondering basically what's going to happen. And we could see Ilana was a bit shocked. You know, she's 24. We were all a bit fried in a sense. But Ian's guitar arrived, so David said to him, can you play anything? We could just, you know, the Bible tells you us to encourage each other with songs and psalms. So that's basically what we thought was a good idea, because we were lost for words in any other respect. And he said, the only thing I can play without sheets of music is Amazing Grace. We were like, great, we all knew it. So he sat on a piece of defunct furniture that was on this platform, and he played his guitar and we sang along. And it really did encourage us. And it focused us back on the reason we first went there. Or the whole reason we were all out there was because we were Christians and we were doing what God had asked us to do. And as Ian stood up and walked towards us, we were sitting still on the floor on the mats. There was a sort of couple of cracks. Now, I, you know, for me, it sounded like electrical impulses. I had no idea what it was. And Ian fell forward into our lap. And I sort of jumped forward and said, Ian, are you okay? And patted his back. I thought he'd fainted, or I don't know what I thought. And then I realised he'd been shot in the back of the head. And it was literally instantaneous. It took, you know, it was a very calculated shot. It was an execution shot to the back of the head, and At that point, David said to Alana and I, get in the water, get in the water. So we jumped into the flooded thing, which was, you know, we couldn't put our feet in the ground, so it was very deep. And we held on to the edge of the thing. And it was at that point, you think, is our faith real? We'd just seen one of our best friends shot. From where we didn't know and why we didn't know and were they coming for us? And, you know, you're so shocked and fearful, but that's the point where the rubber meets the road. And although the shock and the horror of seeing a friend shot, it didn't deter from the fact that we had a God who was with us. And we were, as we held on to the sides of this thing, thinking we were going probably to die, we were praying.
So how long were you there all together? And how did, I mean, how did the rescue take place, if you like? You know, what happened at that point?
We were there. We were kept captive for 22 days on the on a different platform, because they actually moved us that day and left Ian's body where it was. And there ensued quite a, at the beginning, a very brutal and brutalising kind of captivity, until we made some relationships with some of the men and managed to find some humanity in some of them, and we managed to share our faith with them. And actually, towards the end, two of them were asking us to do Bible studies with them, because we had asked for a Bible and miraculously we'd been given one. So for us, the Bible kept us sane. The Bible provided a reaching out to the men. We struggled, you know, to find our sanity after seeing our friend shot. And God was clear in speaking to us that we should pray and read the Bible. And people might think that sounds crazy, but actually the Word of God was what kept us sane. It gave us a focus. It gave us dignity back. And it encouraged us not to be afraid of the men, but to turn towards them. Initially, we were turned with our back to them, not wanting to engage eye contact. And as we literally read the Bible and acted out what it said, the Bible says to give food to your enemy if he's hungry, or give water to your enemy if he's thirsty. Well, we had some bread and we had some water. We discussed it and we offered it to them. Some of them backed off, and, you know, it was as if we'd had a gun in our hand. Others took it with great surprise and great shock, but they took it. And that transaction changed the relationship with at least three of them, who then, as I say, asked about our faith, asked why we were there, asked why we could be nice to them. One of them had a broken ankle and he couldn't walk with it. And David said, if you get some plaster of Paris from one of the chemist shops in the town somewhere, I'll fix that. And he was shocked. He said, why would you do that? We've kidnapped you. And he said, because I can separate that from the fact that you're a man in pain and in need, and we serve a God that loves you as well as he loves us. So that was miraculous. So our captivity, although it started off horrific, we felt God's presence in it. We were able to share our faith with three of the men, and they became very close to us, and they became very helpful in whatever small ways they could. And I think having some human outreach whilst in that very horrific situation just makes things palatable. And as we prayed, we felt, as the Bible said, you must forgive those who persecute you, forgive those who despitefully use you, and pray for them. So we did that. This wasn't a conscious thought. We were reading it and we thought, we'll do this. Jesus has said this, we'll do it. And as we did it out loud, they heard it. So they heard us praying that for them and their children and their wives, and praying that we would forgive them, that we had no animosity, and that God would forgive them too. So it changed things.
So now that relationship had changed, how did you then get out of that situation? I mean, what were they after? You know, what changed that situation? Yeah, so, and was it, did you give that to them and that's how you were released, or...?
Well, they wanted a huge sum of money. Initially, they said 1 billion naira, which is B, billion, which is about 2.75 million pounds. We said to them, we don't have that. There's no way we have anything like that. And even if we pulled everyone in the UK together that we knew, no one could raise that. We told them we're a small charity. We're just a normal family back in the UK. So we couldn't pay it, and they wanted it brought over in cash. And we were saying, you can't do that. You can't bring cash from the UK. There's checks all the way over. We weren't sure really what they were after, to be honest. And we did meet with an intermediate from the government who had been a militant, who had turned kind of gamekeeper, turned, you know, poacher turned gamekeeper. So he was trusted by them and trusted by the government. He came in, he did a proof of life with us at a different area, took some pictures, and he did some negotiations along with the Foreign Office, who were amazing, who couldn't do anything directly but put a lot of pressure on the Nigerian government. And, you know, how we got out is something we can't really discuss because it endangers a number of protocols. But from our point of view, we got out because God made a way for us to get out.
So you're still involved with the charity.
Yes.
But you're living back here now. So the idea anyway was to kind of release it into their hands and allow them to take over.
We have been back though.
Yes.
In February we went back, which wasn't an easy thing.
No.
But we went back and it was absolutely wonderful because they are our family in Nigeria. We love these people and we miss them. So it was great. So.
Yeah. A much more positive experience. But
yeah.
The aftermath and Ian's family, and now you've written this book. I mean, it sounds cliche to say it, and we're gonna have to sort of roll this up now. But it sounds like, but has that situation sort of changed your outlook on life?
Absolutely and irrevocably, forever. Yes.
In what way?
Well, if I was, you know, reliant on God before and thought that God and the promises of Jesus Christ in the Bible were real, I'm 150,000,000% more so now. There is nothing that anyone could say to undermine.
And surely people would say that to you now. I mean, you've written this book, which presumably is about, you know, what you went through. But do you get that? Do you get people just saying to you, you're mad? I mean, what kind of a God are you serving if he allows situations like that?
Surprisingly not. And in fact, I think one of the most recent experiences we had, we were at a wedding, well, my son's wedding. So we were a lot of people at his wedding in their 20s. Millennials, you know, lovely young people, professionals. Speaking to them afterwards, they were so interested as to what had happened to us, because obviously they knew, and why we would do what we did. Why did we go to that area? And normally we would experience a shutdown, especially from a millennial who, you know, they're post-Christian, they've not heard about Jesus Christ in school, it's all been removed, so it's all anathema to them. These people had the same experience. They weren't sure what Christianity was. This is in our own country, a Judeo-Christian basis, and we've got people now in their 20s and 30s and under who have never heard what Christianity is. So we had the experience of speaking to these lovely young people who were not people who had looked at Christianity and rejected it. They just didn't know what it was. And because of the experience we'd had, and because they knew what we'd come through and what we'd been doing for 15 years, they allowed us to tell them. So it gave us an inroad to explain. And they were not rejecting, they were not vilifying, they were surprised. And they were surprised at what we believed in, because they thought Christianity was a dry, church-based, you can't do this, you must do that. And we told them it's a relationship with a living God, Jesus Christ.
Mm.
And why else would we put our life on the line? So, surprisingly not, when we tell people, because people can't actually second guess your story, can they? They can't poke holes in what you've experienced. They can't tell you what you went through is not true. People, in the main, I mean, you will get some people who are, you know, nasty about things, but in the main, we found that people have been surprised, and in a good way.
So the book, is it out now already, or is it coming?
It's coming out in May.
Coming out in May, yeah. And it's called
It's called Counting the Cost, Kidnapped in the Niger Delta. I think it will be available on Amazon in May. Yeah.
And presumably that kind of working through that was, I guess, a sort of cathartic experience as well.
It was.
Being able to put it down on paper, get it out of your system and actually explain to people what was going on. Well, my goodness, so much there, really. And, you know, I thank you so much for joining me today and talking about it. And, you know, I guess there's so much more actually detail that we can't talk because of time. But people can read it all in the book and really get to grips with what you're saying. Yeah. So thank you, and do send my best to David as well, because I know that he had to work today and couldn't come along. But my best to you both, and to Alana, of course, and to Ian's family and friends.
Interestingly, I'll just point out, Alana is now a trustee with us.
So it didn't put her off in the end.
Didn't. We found amazing. A wonderful trustee in her.
Amazing. Yeah. Thank you. Okay, so that was Shirley Donovan. We're going to go to the travel now. And just amazing. Catch that book if you can. And that's great. Thank you so much.